I'm going to call the Public Safety Finance Division to order. Thank you all for coming on this frigid morning. Minnesotans should be used to this, but we're not. I would like to just go over the agenda real quickly, and then I'm going to have some have us all introduce ourselves. So I want to go over the committee rules today. I'm going to have Mr. Carter go over some of the or all of the accounts that are under the jurisdiction of this division. And then we've asked four different groups to come and speak to us about the appropriations that were made to them in the last biennium and what was successful in our efforts. And that's basically what we're going to do today. So I think just in terms of introductions, let me first, where is Erica? Is she now not in the room here? Okay. Erica is, I'll wait till she gets back, but she is our page again this session. And Josh, do you want to just wave your, are you out there? This is John, Josh Borkin. He's the, he's our intern for this committee. And Josh is in his final year of law school at Hamline. Correct. Okay, so welcome, Josh. So I'll start with introductions, and let's just, for members who are used to this, but let's just not give our district, let's, you know, if you can just say where, I don't even know where half the numbers are, so if you could tell us what where you actually represent, maybe how long you've been a legislator and what you do if you're not a in your non-legislative time here. And we'll do that also with the staff. I'm Michael Pema. This is my seventh term in the legislature. I represent 64B, which is, if people know St. Paul at all, it's sort of the Highland Park and the Callister Groveland areas where St. Thomas and St. Catharines is and St. Paul. I've been on this committee, I think, since the beginning when it was the Judiciary Committee, and have served almost in every term in some capacity in public safety. And when I'm not a legislator, for the last 25 years, I've worked on behalf of crime victims and currently work with the Battered Women's Justice Project, which is a federally funded program that provides technical assistance and training to programs and states and cities around the country on how to confront family violence. So with that, I think I'll move to Melanie and have you just introduce yourself and about yourself, Melanie?
Melanie McMahon, the committee administrator for Public Safety Finance, and I was the committee administrator for this committee for the past 2 years as well. And I live in St. Paul, so traffic's not as bad for me as some of you.
Hi, I'm Libby Wireman. I'm the committee legislative assistant and have been these last 2 years. Before coming to the House in 2005, I worked for a nonprofit called Watch, a court monitoring organization that looks at court cases of domestic violence, assault, and child abuse. I was also a crime victim advocate. And I live in Northeast, so my drive here was awful. So I apologize for my lateness. And when I'm not here, I'm a policy fellow at the Humphrey. So I'm working very hard on that.
And if I may say, these two are terrific, and they will, whether Republican or Democrat, if you need help in this committee, they will be there for you. Okay.
I'm Dave Olin, Vice Chair of this committee. I represent the northwest corner, Rosal, Kitson, part of Marshall, and part of Pennington. In my prior life, I was 32-year Pennington County Attorney, so that's my background. As far as what I'm doing when I'm done with the legislature, at the moment, I'm basically a retired county attorney. I go wander around and I talk to people, basically. I haven't been doing anything else because I didn't put up my own shingle because part-time is too many conflicts.
Thank you.
I'm Deborah Hilsum. I represent the City of Brooklyn Center and parts of Brooklyn Park. I have served on the Public Safety Policy or Finance or Combined Committee since I came to the legislature. This is my fifth term. And when I'm not in the legislature, I'm currently a law student at William Mitchell. And I am a mother, and I do massage in my spare time.
And Representative Hillstrom is also the chair of the Public Safety Policy Committee, which is this year.
I'm Representative John Ward from Brainerd, Baxter, Crosby, Wilmington, Nisswa, up in the central part of the state where everybody likes to go. and come in the summer. We encourage you to do that. This is my second term. My first term, however, on this committee, I'm really excited about the opportunity to serve on this committee, so thank you for that. And when I'm not down here, I'm a retired teacher for 34 years, retired teacher, and just like to spend time with my family and my grandkids.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Representative Hawes, and I love to retire because I've retired three times, and it's all were enjoyable. I'm a past county commissioner for Stearns County. I was a lifetime park and recreation director for the city of St. Cloud, over 30 years there. And originally I was a math teacher and a coach. I represent the eastern part of St. Cloud, which includes the State College, the Tech College, and the hospital, East St. Cloud, and Haven Township.
Thank you. I'm Representative Larry Hosh. I'm starting my third term. I represent central Minnesota, Stearns County, including the communities of St. Joseph, Alta Painesville, and down to Clearwater. My background in public safety issues pretty much come from me being mayor of St. Joseph and working with the police department and our wonderful chief of police, which some of you may know. My background outside of the legislature, my educational background is in social work. I have my undergrad and my graduate degree. I'm a Johnny, and I represent St. John's. I always have to point that out. We have a Tommy representative here. And what I do outside of the legislature, I own a small construction contracting business.
Thank you.
I will speak very slowly for my colleague, Representative Hosh. Since he went to St. John's, I know that they have a hard time comprehending things that happen quickly. I'm Paul Coles. I'm a graduate of the University of St. Thomas, a proud graduate of the University of St. Thomas. I'm starting my fourth term. I represent the cities of Victoria, Waconia, Watertown, Cologne, New Germany, Hamburg, Norwood, Young America, Carver, and part of Chaska in central and western Carver County, and 11 townships, including three in Scott County. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, I have the largest, geographically the largest district in the seven-county metro area. I'm lead Republican on this committee this year. Looking forward to working with you, Mr. Chairman, and appreciated the opportunity to chat with you a little bit yesterday afternoon about the committee and the work that we'll be doing. Clearly, we're going to have a big challenge, primarily given the budget situation we're in. But I think that as you've shown over the last 2 years, and I think there's been a history in this committee that I think you might address a little bit later on about public safety. The public safety committee is probably the most bipartisan committee, or one of the most bipartisan committees in the legislature. And I look forward to working with you to maintain that tradition. And I look forward to working with my members and the Democrat members as we try to deal with and wrestle this massive challenge that we have ahead of us.
Thank you.
I'm Carla Bingham. I represent Cottage Grove, South St. Paul, St. Paul Park, Newport, and St. Cloud Island Township. When I'm not here, I am a paralegal at the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, and I've been doing that for 5 years next week. This is my second term. I've sat on this committee, and I believe this year sit on most of the public safety committees. And I'm excited because this year I'm vice chair of the Public Safety Policy Committee. Moving on up, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
No, I'm not getting taller.
Marty. I'm Tony Cornish. I'm a retired game warden and currently chief of police of Lake Crystal. This is my fourth term, and I represent parts mostly of Waseca County, except the city of Waseca, all of Blue Earth County, except the county seat of Mankato, and the two-thirds of Faribault County, and I border my station border, or the district, I should say, borders Iowa, so I'm way down there.
Thank you. Dennis?
I'm Dennis Bird, I'm a Republican research consultant.
My name is Kate
Lee,
I'm with
CFL Caucus. Thank you. Before we go to the next slide, Representative Reinert, you want to introduce yourself?
Mr. Chairman, Roger Reinert. I am from Duluth, so way up there, the central and western parts of the city of Duluth.
Mr. Reinert used to be the president of the Duluth City Council, a position that I once held in my my other life. Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Steve Smith, I represent the communities Western Hennepin County, St. Bonnie, Mound, Minnetrista, Spring Park, Independence, Medina, Maple Plain, and Loretto and Southwest Plymouth. So everything from St. Bonnie to Plymouth. I'm starting my 10th term, and every year since I was first elected in 1990, I have served on judiciary finance or public safety finance. Beginning in 1999, the beginning of 8 years of the Age of Enlightenment, when the House had majority Republican control, I had the honor of chairing civil law, the House Civil Law Committee for 2 terms, the Public Safety Policy Committee, and then Public Safety Finance prior to your taking the gavel. So I have requested to be on this committee again. Representative Cole will be your lead Republican, so I'm going to sit back and enjoy watching both of you.
Thank you.
Well, my name is Tim Kelly. It's my first term representing Red Wing area just south of here, Lake City, Cannon Falls, down to Wabasha, and down Red Wing. I'm a financial advisor as well.
Welcome.
Thank you.
And I'm Carolyn Lane, representing Columbia Heights, Fridley, Little Peace, St. Anthony, second term, and interested to widen my view of what happens around this legislature by being on the Public Safety Committee.
Welcome.
I'm Rob Eastland. I'm in my 5th term. I represent the area north of the metro, part of Isani County, part of Chisago County, part of Anoka County, cities of St. Francis, Cambridge, Isanti, Harris, that area of the state. This is my 5th term. I've been on public safety committee on this committee for four of those terms. This will be the 4th time. And outside of the legislature, I guess I'm a husband and a father, and I got 3 grandkids in the last 2 years, and 1 on the way. So that part of my life is getting much more positive, and I'm enjoying that. And I also have a real estate property management company, and I do some farming.
Thank you.
Good morning, Tina Liebling. I am in my 3rd term. I sat on this committee in my last term. I'm an attorney, have done mostly criminal defense throughout my career, some public defender work. And whenever we do introductions like this, I always feel really fortunate because it's really easy for me to say that my district is part of Rochester instead of a whole list of places, like so many of you.
Good morning. I'm Dan Severson. I represent District 14A, which is Stock Rapids, Sartell, Holding Ford, Rice, St. Stephen. Numerous townships, half of Stearns and about half of Benton counties. I've been in the legislature for my 4th term. Probably my legal experience is being a legal officer in the military for 22 years. I've had several exposures to that process, so I'm very interested in seeing this side of the House. And this is my first term on the public safety, so I'm very interested in the processes and being able to help how I can. The outside, I basically I retired in 2000 from military, and been looking for someone to hire me after getting hired to the legislature since then in my off time, which doesn't tend to be too much time. So those are challenges, but maybe we can create some jobs here.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Becky Perius, and I work with House Research. It's a nonpartisan legal research office, and I'm happy to be here.
I'm Jeff Diebel. I'm also with House Research, and this is my 8th session, I believe. I'm actually a JAG officer as well.
Oh, no kidding.
So I might have some in common there.
I wasn't JAG, but I was legal.
And I'm Gary Carter. I'm the fiscal analyst for the committee, and I've been here since 1995.
Okay, thank you. And Erica, is she here now? Oh, there she is. There's her. Okay, I just wanted to acknowledge you there. Okay. In your packets, members, you should have a copy of the committee rules. I believe they're identical, almost identical to last year. I just might want to make a couple of comments about them. Then I have a couple of comments, and we'll go into our presentation for today. As you see, I really don't would prefer that you not bring your laptop to committee except for staff. And I would ask that you please turn your cell phones off. They disrupt the electrical system up here, and I would ask that agency staff also be respectful of the body and not bring your cell phones in here. I think the only other change here is that we're requesting that the bill authors and testifiers bring 50 copies of any handouts that they may have, as well as a list of testifiers to the committee administrator or committee legislative assistant at least one day prior to the hearing. I wanted to say that we will, of course, have a an omnibus finance bill, and Representative Hillstrom will have an omnibus policy bill. And I you know, as you probably know, there's four public safety divisions, so we're not entirely sure how all of the bills will get routed from Representative Mullery's Civil Justice Committee and Representative Lesch's Crime Victims Division. But ultimately, they will either rest, I would assume, in Representative Hillstrom's omnibus policy bill or here in the omnibus finance bill. Anything else in the committee rules, Representative Coles? Did you have a chance to look at them? Is there anything?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a chance to read them quickly after I sat down, and they appear to be consistent with what we've seen in the past. I think they look just fine.
Okay. And I would only ask members, but this is one thing I am sort of a stickler about, and I really believe that you know, the public is watching us sometimes on television, and staff and members of the public are in the audience. When people are testifying before the committee, I would just ask that you provide them respect and listen to them and for the conversations. I know that not all chairs have that rigidity about them, but I think that we should do that as public servants here, so I will try to enforce that as best that I can. Before I turn it over to Mr. Carter, let me just make a 2 minutes worth of comments. As Representative Cole said, we did have a conversation yesterday, and I, Representative Smith, to both of you, I really believe that public safety is a nonpartisan issue. And it's not a matter of being soft on crime or tough on crime, but rather being smart in how we confront crime. And for those of you who were on this committee last year, I think that you would agree that we had a fair and inclusive process, and I intend to have a similar process this session. Representative Coles, who's the lead Republican on this committee, and I met for a period of time yesterday, and it's my desire that you and I work together, that your caucus and our caucus work together, and I want each of you to know that my door is always open to each and every one of you. I believe, as has been said before on this committee, that public safety is a core government function. And if I had my druthers, we would not make any cuts. But at the end of the day, I think some reductions will be inevitable, whether in actual cuts or not resolving agencies' deficits that are under the jurisdiction of this committee. And having gone through this process in 2003, I don't relish this task, but I ask for each member to be thoughtful and strategic during our budgetary deliberations. And I ask that the commissioners and staff from departments and agency under the jurisdiction of this committee to be patient as we go through this process. While we await the governor's budget, this committee will be asking for financial information from you to help us make informed decisions. This legislature has huge challenges ahead. We must balance this budget. And while the governor has stated that he wants to hold public safety harmless, I don't think anyone can say with certainty what our target will ultimately be, and which is why we have no other option but to scrutinize the budget methodically. Since we met last year, we've had ideas that have come forward for reform and efficiency, which we should evaluate, but in my view, we should never sacrifice the public safety of the citizenry of the state. All ideas should be on the table, both short-term and long-term. I would ask that members who have bills that increase penalties or create laws that impact state public policy you should consider the fiscal impact to both the state of Minnesota as well as local jurisdictions, and we will be analyzing the fiscal notes here more closely. I look forward to working with you. I look forward to your ideas, and I look forward to dialogue and debate as we move forward. My only condition will be that we try to be civil and respectful to one to each other, and if we do, I'm confident, despite the challenges, that the committee will be successful. So thank you, members, and with that, I'd like to turn the meeting over to Gary Carter to go through the accounts that are under the jurisdiction of this committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. First of all, I just want to point out one thing. I mean, there's been a few references made here to 2003. You're going to see one page from the 2003 spreadsheet. It's the legal size one. For new members, it'll also give you a sort of like a background and or some idea of what the spreadsheet will look like. So you can see under column A, which was the conference committee, which was approved by both the Senate and the House, when you look under decision items, you can see all the negatives there. 2003 was also when they did away with a lot of the grants to counties, and that's when the legislature and the governor and DOC recommended that short-term offenders 6 months or less be held by the local jails. So with that, once again, the budget outlook is bad for 10 and 11. It's close to $5 billion. We just received a memo from Bill Marks yesterday showing that the forecast the revenue that came in November and December of this of 08 was $131 million below the projection. So with that, the other thing I want to point out too is that in your packet is what's on the finance website. It's just an example of a post board. And it gives you some idea, you know, especially for new members, if you want information on the agencies, you can pull this off Finance's website, or we can even pull it off for you. It's going to tell you a little about the agency, the core purposes, the operations, and it's also going to go a little into the base budget funding on that agency. The governor's budget should come out the 27th of this month. Then we will receive detailed information on the budget. The other important date here is the end of February. We're going to have the February forecast, and if the February forecast is below expectations, then the governor will also be making adjustments to his budget. So with that, any questions, and then I'll go into the agencies, just a brief description of programs.
Since Mr. Carter, I have a question or two for you. Since you did reference a specific when back in 03 that the state assigned short-term prisoners to local jurisdictions, did the state legislature also assign a dollar amount per diem to cover those costs? What was that amount, and what's the history that happened to that amount?
Mr. Carter.
Mr. Chair, the amount was around $12 per day. And that was based on 200 short-term offenders a year. The history of that is it was increased during the 2007 session. That's when we had a surplus. Last year in 2008, there was somewhat of a deficit again, and that amount went down. Right now, I think it's around $8 a day. And also the numbers of short-term offenders have gone up. And I do believe we're hearing short-term offenders next Thursday. This Thursday.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions at this point?
Okay, briefly, we'll go through the accounts then. You have a sheet listing the accounts, and this is how the agency, the budgets, will be set up. And it's usually the agency, smaller, then there's programs. If it's a large agency, you'll have programs, and then under the programs, you're going to have activities. Now, what further complicates matters is that finance allows the agencies to present their budgets by either program and activity or just by program. So you're going to see some differences. Department of Public Safety, they will always show the budget pages. They will show the activity level. Corrections and the courts, they will not show the activity level. They will only show in the budget the program. But once again, if you need more information on that, we can definitely get that. But we'll just start out. We have the courts, the three courts, the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals, and the trial courts. They make up about 30% of the public safety budget. We have the tax court. This is an executive branch agency. one of the smaller agencies, Uniform Laws Commission, the Board of Judicial Standards. Then the next one is the Public Defense Board. This makes up about 7% of the budget here. Then we have the Public Safety Department. This makes up about 15% of the budget, and it does not include all the programs in public safety. It, what we are missing, and we are missing the driver and vehicle services, pipeline safety, the state patrol, and traffic safety, and then also administrative and related services. Those programs are found in the Department of Transportation. And Representative Cornish and Representative Tamar, we always get this question on why don't we have the state patrol? And, you know, I still don't know that that answer. And I think mainly it's because it is a trunk highway. They mainly are trunk highway funded. We also have the Post Board.
Nicole.
Sure. Mr. Carter, could you just identify what the remainder of the public safety, the DPS budget is? We've got, looks like, $309 or $310 million here on this committee. How much of their budget is comes out of Chair Leader's Committee?
Listen, I may have to get back to you on that. We can take a look, maybe have that information by the end of the meeting. Then we have the Private Detective Board. The next page we have the other agency is the Human Rights Department. And then under that is the Department of Corrections. This is the largest agency we have. It has about 47% of the budget. You can see under, it has the three programs, institutions, community services, operations support, and the institutions, you're going to have the prisons. There also is there's the private prison that we have, and they're also housing some inmates in local jails. And then the last agency is sentencing guidelines. So just a brief overview of what we have. There's also a sheet in there with a pie chart that's showing the agencies and once again as a percent of the budget and what the base budget is for these agencies.
Mr. Carter, so the federal funds that come into to these departments also, so they would, do you know offhand or do you want to get back to us, like the Office of Justice Programs obviously gets a fair amount of federal money. Are there others here, agencies that get federal money that we should be examining?
Right. I think, you know, we will see under public safety, the Office of Justice Programs, as you pointed out, Homeland Security, Emergency Management, that's a big federally funded program, especially with some of the disasters, because the feds pick up a big share of the disasters. The Supreme Court has some funding. They have funding, I think, they're getting some federal funding for the drug courts and also for some child support, I believe, and some other items. Corrections, they also receive some federal funding. They're probably, I think they're getting some reentry funding, and also there's some chemical dependency funding. And then there may be some other smaller funding for some of the other agencies or programs.
And is it premature to look at any of the projected stimulus package to see if any of our agencies would benefit from that as we move forward with the state budget?
I think we might want to keep our eyes open on that. I don't know how it will affect public safety, but NCSL, we just received an email. They do have a website now that will be sending us updates.
Okay, very good. Questions for Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carter, following up on Representative Tamar's question, I also sit on healthcare committees, and in healthcare there's a lot of times where if you cut a state dollar, the agency also loses a federal dollar with that. Does that happen in public safety at all? Are you talking about federal funds coming in? Is there any place that's connected that way?
Mr. Carter.
You know, Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, the only thing I can think of right now is the Adam Walsh Act, and Representative Hilstrom may be able to help me out on that. If we do not enact that, we will lose, I think it's 10% of our burn funding, which is a federal funding for COPS programs, prevention. That's the only one.
You're having a hearing on this, aren't you?
Correct, Mr. Chair. We are having a hearing joint with the Senate next, a week from this coming Thursday.
And is Mr. Carter accurate about the loss of state funding? Or
That is what is going on, but we're all watching to see if with the new administration there are any changes in those penalties.
Very good. Thank you. Any other questions, Mr. Carter? Okay, then. Well, we'll move ahead. We have invited today four different organizations that have been funded by this committee. Ms. Carter, just so I'm clear now here, the network was a grant made to the Department of Corrections would have oversight over that, and crime victims organizations would come under DPS. Mentoring Children of Incarcerated Parents would come under DOC. What is YIPA? Oh, that's OJP too. I just wanted to make sure that that's where the grants were.
Right.
So all of these programs provide some intervention and prevention with either youth or crime victims or perpetrators in our system. The idea, of course, is that all of them have an impact on reducing crime and promoting public safety in the state of Minnesota. So we asked each of them to provide some testimony here to give us sort of an analysis, although not as detailed maybe as we might ask in the future, about their budget, how their funds were spent, and then to explain what they were able to accomplish. I think whether it's a division within an agency or whether it's a bill that asks for money from this committee, I think it's incumbent upon us as a committee to find out whether we got what they were projecting, what were the results, and that's the purpose of having at least this brief introduction to some of the grants that were made out of this committee. So I'd like, who do we have first here? The network, if you folks could come forward, and I do think that there's a copy, is it in the package? What about the budget? Okay, so you should have a packet of materials from the network, and for those of you who are new to the committee, Mr. Thomas, I welcome to the committee and to all your presenters, and there are some new members to this committee, so maybe you had planned on doing this, but if you could explain a little bit about the history of the network and then go into your presentation so they know what you're all about.
Sure, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much for this opportunity. And Mr. Chair, I have incorporated in my remarks a brief overview of who we are and what we do. We 2 years ago, we sat before this committee and presented a bold and ambitious idea. You were generous enough and had faith in our ability to pull this off, and today I'm very happy to report that we have met the expectations set by this committee, by the legislature, and by the Department of Corrections. Again, my name is Steve Thomas, and I'm President and CEO of the Network for Better Futures, and I'm joined at the table today by our Chief Operating Officer, Mr. Darrell Lindsay, and two representatives of the network community, Takuma Sessman and Samus Hill. These men and the other men in the audience for the network represent over 124 men who are currently enrolled in the network, most of whom are former high-risk offenders released by the Department of Correction over the past year. They're all working, and they're all actively engaged in making a better life for themselves, for their families, and our community. Representative Paymar, during the last session, you and your colleagues on this committee and the legislature had the foresight to invest a modest amount of state funds in our bold, cost-effective endeavor, and I'm pleased to report today, and we'll describe in a few minutes, that we've met all the performance expectations that were set for us. Quite simply, we have emerging evidence that the network is a proven means for reducing state spending, creating new jobs, and achieving much better results for an expensive group of high-risk consumers of public services. First, some background. The network is reducing the economic and social cost of high-risk ex-offenders, primarily African-American men, with histories of incarceration, substance abuse, mental illness, chronic unemployment, and homelessness. This ambitious endeavor was created and is being sponsored by a team of Minnesota's leading healthcare, housing, workforce, community corrections, and human service practitioners. A core feature of our enterprise is Better Futures. It's our business enterprise which creates jobs for the high-risk men that are enrolled and provides immediate short-term work for our participants. It also generates earned income for our enterprise.
by setting high expectations and providing direct access to the resources one needs to meet these expectations, namely housing, health insurance, behavioral health and primary health care, short-term employment, and community re-engagement. Men in the network are offered the opportunity to become contributing, productive, and positive men in our community. Each man, when they enroll, is expected to step up and transform from a client totally dependent on public care to a worker who earns a wage, pays taxes and child support, and pays their restitution. The core ingredients of the network's approach are also proven means for reducing recidivism and criminal activity. And in the future, if we receive continued funding in the next biennium, we're willing to share some of the financial risk if these better results are not achieved. And now Daryl will take a few minutes to share some of the performance highlights from 2008, our first year of service, and then I'll close out our testimony.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee. My name is Daryl Lindsay. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for the Network for Better Futures. I'd like to take just a few moments to present some of our initial performance data over the past 12 months. We formally launched our endeavor last January, and since then, we have enrolled 224 high-risk men. 85% of these men were enrolled under our contract with the Department of Corrections. 124 of these men are still active with us today for a retention rate of nearly 60%. They are living and working in Hennepin and Ramsey counties. All of our men are working full or part-time jobs with private employers, or they are working on our Better Futures work crew. About 70% of the men meet the state's definition for long-term homelessness, and nearly all of our men have histories of drug addiction and alcohol abuse, and a very high percentage of the men are coping with mental illness or some other type of behavioral health issue. We're working to gather better data about actual income earned and child support paid, but we do know that the men have earned over $260,000 in wages by working on our Better Futures work crew. And the men employed by other employers report that they are collectively earning over $1 million annually. In addition, these same men report that they have paid over $80,000 in child support in 2008. We also know that about 50 men were sanctioned for violations of their release conditions, and practically all of these sanctions were for technical violations. We were able, however, to work with the county agents and restructure the release conditions for 16 of these men. The effect was that 16 men did not go back to prison, and the state avoided a cost of about $210,000. Through our business enterprise, we have created more than 30 jobs and generated $275,000 in earned income. In addition, we have used the legislature's appropriation of $1.55 million to leverage more than $4.8 million and other sources of private and public investment. And the appropriation has helped us to master lease and provide short-term rent subsidy for nearly 120 apartments. This enables the men to secure the type of quality housing that they would rarely be able to access in the open market. Overall, we are enrolling the number and type of high-risk ex-offenders that the legislature and the Department of Corrections expected us to serve, and we have met performance expectations related to retention, employment, and child support payments. We have also connected men to the range of primary health and behavioral health services that are needed to support their transition and success in the community. Finally, we are about to engage researchers from the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York to conduct a thorough analysis of our performance and calculate the economic and social benefits of our work, including the amount of savings that we are generating for the state.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Daryl. Let me just close with two thoughts. First, our initial success has been significant, but we know we can get much better, especially in how technical violations are managed and averting more men from going back to prison and managing high rates of substance abuse and relapse that occurs. But there's some key reasons for our initial success. First, we're paid to perform, and in the next biennium, we're prepared to reduce our fixed rate by 25% if we're funded to double our enrollment. And we are willing to enter into a risk-sharing agreement with the state. This reimbursement approach provides a real incentive for us to produce better outcomes. Second, our approach is built on proven practices that are known to produce, reduce public safety and reduce recidivism while maintaining public safety. And our partners' collective track record and power enabled us to perform at a high level and meet expectations. Just briefly to the appropriation, a handout in your packet summarizes how the appropriation has been spent to date in 2008. As you can see, it represents about a third of our revenue, and it's being used to cover a portion of the salaries of our frontline staff, a portion of the wages we pay participants, and a major share of the costs related to leasing, housing, and providing rent subsidies. We are on course to fully expend the appropriation by June, and we will likely stop enrolling new men in March to meet this target. Let me just close my remarks by offering some insights and recommendations for how the state can sustain and grow cost-saving endeavors like the network during this time of economic distress. We believe that the current economic crisis, which is viewed by most as the worst since the Great Depression, provides the legislature with a compelling and rare opportunity to be inventive, to reform ineffective practices, and reduce spending on expensive options like prisons. We've heard over the past few months that the legislature and the governor are eager and committed to finding great new ideas and new ways of doing business. The speaker invited people to submit bold ways to reform government practices and spending. We believe the network is one such proposal. But serious reform is disruptive and threatening. Reform forces a change in current practices and the status quo, and serious reform also entails more than tweaking a line item or agency budget. Our reform addresses complex issues that benefits multiple agencies and sectors, and it's hard for current structures to absorb and incorporate such a new approach. With this in mind, there's two reforms that we respectfully suggest this committee should consider and adopt. First, consider reducing the time served for certain crimes, especially victimless crimes related to drug use and abuse. And second, virtually eliminate the practice of sending offenders back to prison for technical violations of their release conditions. There are a growing number of studies and many practices from across the country that demonstrate how these reforms are enabling jurisdictions to control and reduce spending on prisons without compromising public safety. And a portion of these reforms are being invested in community-based reentry alternatives like the NEX network. A critical caveat, however, is that these reforms must be coupled with a wise investment in the economic and social supports that an ex-offender needs upon release. Overall, the approach is pretty basic. Control and cut spending on prisons by implementing policies that do not compromise public safety. Use a portion of the savings to close the state's budget gap, and use the remaining portion of the savings to support the offender's successful reentry into the community. And we recommend another change in policy and practice that is cost neutral. Use the state's purchasing power to create job opportunities for ex-offenders and social ventures like our Better Futures Enterprises. Even during this fiscal crisis, the state will advance construction projects and it will purchase basic services like janitorial services and recycling. We can achieve multiple economic and social benefits by making employers like Better Futures the first source for the low-skilled labor needed to complete these projects and provide purchase services. We at the network, which includes more than 120 ex-offenders who are committed to transforming their lives after years in prison, are committed to helping the committee and the legislature formulate and adopt these cost-saving reforms and achieve much better results during a time of fiscal distress. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas and Mr. Lindsay. Any questions? We're going to bring these folks back again and talk about this issue in more detail. The network, we funded in the last biennium, but the Department of Corrections also has a reentry program through MCOR. So we want to have, greater discussion in the future. But there's been a rebring.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question maybe for Mr. Carter. Do you know the current average cost of keeping somebody in prison for a year?
Mr. Carter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, which per diem would you like on that? I think it's somewhere in the $30,000 range, roughly. It depends on if it's just a facility or administrative costs or whatever.
Mr. Anything else? Mr. Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I know you mentioned that we're going to have these folks back again, but I'm wondering in the interim if we could have a copy of the speaker's remarks.
Sure, I'm sure he'll provide them.
Thank you.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Thomas and the network folks, thank you. It's very, very impressive what I heard today. Just from a rookie standpoint, this is my first time on this committee. Tell me what are some of the technicalities that put somebody back into the system rather than... Can you give me just a couple examples?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative, the most common are three. Two are... One is related to alcohol use. Usually a person upon release has a prohibition of using alcohol or drugs. So alcohol use, drug use, or not being available, not being where you're supposed to be. So you're on a schedule every week, and if they make a spot check at 2 a.m. and you're not at your apartment, or let's say they go to the work site and you're not there, or you don't show up for a scheduled meeting. And then also more serious issues, like in a couple of cases, men have been rearrested for a new offense, and that's obviously a violation.
Mr. Thomas, in your presentation, do we have, I know this is the first, was that 2 years of research now? Do we find you the 2 years? I mean, I'm trying to get, did you give us a recidivism number in your presentation?
Mr. Chair, no. And we don't know, we've asked the department, we've given them our funding, your funding was for the last biennium.
Yes.
The contract wasn't awarded though, and started in January of 2008. So we're actually going to operate for 18 months with this appropriation. And we want to know what the recidivism number is. We've given the department our list of all the men enrolled in 2008, and we're hopeful, we'd like to see what that shows.
So you must have a number that to how many offenders that were in your program have been sent back to prison. Percentage.
From our understanding, we know...
Regardless of technical...
From our understanding, we know of three men who were rearrested over the last year, and we know that about 30 or so of our technical violators were sent back to prison.
So three were rearrested for committing new crimes then?
And 30 more were arrested for technical violations and sent back to prison.
And is this the money that you're applying for, if I understood your testimony, for further research, are you going to be able to tell us the difference between offenders who are just released from DOC as opposed to those who come through either an MCOR reentry program or your program?
Mr. Chair, just to understand the big picture, one of our private funders is the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. They have committed the funding to fund this independent evaluation, and we will compare the network's results or network participants' results to a group of men like them who don't enroll in the network. I can't say it'll get as precise as comparing MNCOR results to, but it will be other men who are released who are like our men but aren't enrolled. Yes, we will do that comparison.
Thank you. If we're close, then we're going to move on. I apologize to the committee for not maybe scheduling more time for each one of these presentations.
I will heed the subtle advice and try to be brief, Mr. Chairman. I guess the first question I have is, you indicated you're presently serving 124 men, but I think you said you had 224 over the course of the last year or so. We've got 35-ish who have gone back to prison. What's happened to the other 65 or 70 men? Where are they at?
Mr. Thomas.
Mr. Chair, Representative. We'll get you in more detail. Here's generally what's happened. Obviously, a third were violated and sent back, although some of those men re-enroll. We have easily seven or eight men who went, the average term you serve when you go back to prison on a release violation is about 5 months. So we've had a handful of men who went back, came back to us, and now actually they're doing better and stronger. Another large reason for leaving is substance abuse and alcohol abuse. I cannot overstate how serious drug and alcohol issues and mental health issues are in this population. And so that's a large reason why. Now, that doesn't necessarily they went off, and this is why we want to see the data from the department. They may not be anywhere in the system, in the public justice, safety system, but they're not in our network. But the reason for checking out had to do with drug and alcohol abuse. And then we have, and I'll get better evidence on this as we get it together, we've had people who did exactly what we expected of them. They got a job, or they got their own apartment, and now they're out on their own.
And Mr. Chairman, just very quickly, and we don't need, I don't necessarily need an answer today, but I'd be curious when you come back, if you don't have an answer today, what kind of commitment have you received from Hennepin County or the City of Minneapolis or any other public sources in terms of ongoing funding? And then I see from the one-page sort of high-level balance sheet, you've got some earned revenue, some foundation grants. You mentioned the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Can you give me some more information? You don't have to do it now, but maybe when you come back,
sure.
About a little bit more detail about where your money's coming from and what kind of commitments may be out there, so that as we're trying to figure out what we're going to do with our limited resources, we can evaluate where we may or may not be able to participate.
In addition to that information, Mr. Thomas, we'd appreciate also if you provided a little bit more detailed budget than the one that you provided, Ms. McMahon, so we can work through that. So we'll have you folks back again. I think I just wanted to introduce, especially new members, to something that was it's not necessarily new. The criminal justice system has tried to look at reentry programs in the past, and we just want to make sure they're successful if we're funding them. Thank you all for coming, and
thank you.
Appreciate look
forward to seeing
your testimony.
Thank you.
Mr. Beatty, we're now going to hear from Youth Intervention Program. Beatty, if you could try to keep your comments to 5 or 6 minutes, that would be appreciative, unless you have testimony to...
I will do that, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Scott Beatty, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Youth Intervention Programs Association. Most people call it just YIPA. Quickly, YIPA is a nonprofit collaborative organization currently comprised of 90 community-based early intervention programs from around the state of Minnesota. You should have a packet that we provided, a blue packet that's got our YIPA on the front of it. I want you to take a look at that as I go through this. A couple things about YIPA is we provide training and technical assistance to the Youth Intervention Program grantees, in addition to providing training to all sorts of youth service providers, about 3,000 a year, and parents. We provide parent training also to about 1,500 parents a year, because we believe that with training, youth service professionals and educated parents will provide the best possible services and parenting to our youth. I have the honor today to appear before you to report on the Youth Intervention Program. The Youth Intervention Program is a 32-year-old program that currently provides and leverages funding to 67 Minnesota community-based early intervention programs throughout the state. By leveraging, I mean that each one of these programs receiving state dollars have to come up with $2 in community funding for every $1 they get from the state. These early intervention programs work with youth that are first beginning to show signs of troublesome behaviors. You know, it could be shoplifting, vandalism, drug use, truancy, alcohol, tobacco kind of issues, family behavior, bullying, those type of things. What we're trying to get at here is working with kids that are starting to show some initial problems, sort of red flagging, trying to get to them early, work with them, trying to keep them out of the juvenile justice system. The program uses mentoring, counseling, education, restorative justice, and other diversion programming to keep these youth from further involvement in the system. On average, the program serves about 20 to 25,000 kids annually, with a recidivism rate of about 13%. There's other outcomes, and I'll just give you a few that we've been able to keep track of over the years. 85% of the youth increased their decision-making skills. 75% of the youth referred for truancy, improved their school attendance, and 86% report that they developed a relationship with a positive, caring adult. And the one thing I do want to say about that relationship with a positive, caring adult, I think we know that it's so important with these kids when they end up with a mentor or a counselor or a coach or whatever, that those are the kind of things that really make a difference in a kid's lives. Some of them aren't getting the parenting or the help that they need, and these counseling and these mentoring kind of programs do exactly that. Positive outcomes have always been pretty easy to show with this program, but in late 2007, economists from Wilder Research and the University of Minnesota conducted a social return on investment research study on Minnesota's youth intervention programs, which concluded that these types of programs provide a $4.89 return for every dollar of cost. Moreover, the program returns a $14.68 return for every dollar invested, assuming that 2-to-1 match that I was talking to you about a little earlier. Now, I want to direct you to some of the things that are inside the packet. On the right, you'll see a youth intervention program brochure, which now we have all 67 programs listed on the front. You can kind of see we've got some cost effectiveness data and also some outcome data from these programs. If you look in the inside, they've got a map in here which shows where the programs currently are located. You know, one of YIPA's primary goals is to make sure that every youth in Minnesota has access to an early intervention program, and as you can see, there's still a lot of room throughout the state, specifically culturally specific organizations and American Indian organizations throughout the state that we're really working on to, which our goal is to hopefully someday get about 120 of these programs, because if we think that if every community that has a population of about 5,000 of above had one of these programs, we think we could really pretty much cover the state. Now, in 2007, this body provided an additional $750,000 for the Youth Intervention Program. And what that money did, it was one-time money, unfortunately, that happened right at the end of the session, but it provided funding for 13 new programs and also provided additional funding to the 54 other community-based youth intervention programs. And there's a piece in your packet that says New Youth Intervention Programs, 2008-2009. These are the programs that were funded by the 13 programs. I do want to say something that I think really happened very well within the Department of Public Safety and the Office of Justice Programs, is YIPA really made a recommendation to them that we really felt with this new money, what we needed to have done is to take a look at American Indian populations, culturally specific populations in greater Minnesota. And they really did a fantastic job, I think, in selecting the programs that were funded. You can see the amounts of money that these folks are getting. That the $50,000, the $46,000, those are over 2 years. And then, of course, they have to come up with their community matching dollars. On the second page, we've got all the programs that are receiving the funding and the amounts that they are getting, both total for the two-year biennium and also each of the specific years. I do want to say that $750,000, at least we know that in 2008, provided services to an additional 3,500 kids. So it really had a huge impact throughout the state. Of course, the big issue is the funding. And the base funding for the Youth Intervention Program is $1.65 million. That when the one-time $750,000 was added on, it brought it to $2.4 million. Of course, we have a real concern of what's going to happen because this is one-time money about these 13 programs and the additional services that these other 54 agencies were able to provide. you know, with this one-time money, our, of course, our concern is what's going to happen with all those kids. So I guess I'll open this up for questions at this point, if you have any, about the program. Again, we know there's need when there was the $750,000 available. There was over 50 agencies that asked for a grant, and only 13 were able to get it. So, I mean, I think that shows you that throughout the state there's a significant need for these kind of programs.
Thank you, Mr. Beattie. Representative Close.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Beattie, can you share with us a little bit some of the thinking behind funding 13 new programs with one-time money as opposed to better funding or more fully funding existing programs? We've set up a situation now where you're coming back saying it was one-time money, and now we need it to be ongoing money, and we've got a fiscal issue, and I'm not criticizing the work that's being done. I'm trying to understand the thought process behind starting to fund new programs with one-time money.
Mr. Beattie.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Close, when we had the bill in front of us, the bill actually asked for the money to be put in the base. It was right at the end of the session. There were some tails issues. I don't know what happened there. But it ended up with, you know, being one-time money, and it happened right at the very end of the session, and it was something that was a very big disappointment to us, because we know that these are ongoing. This money is intended to be ongoing money with these community matching dollars. We didn't know what was going to happen with the budget. We had hoped by this year that things would be better. So that's just sort of the cards that were handed to us at that point.
Mr. Beattie, though, in fairness to the committee, I mean, we had a tails problem at the end, and we changed that, but you could have redirected that money to existing programs, couldn't you?
We did put some money into existing programs. We kind of felt like it was shared out.
That's enough to close, and we have two more presentations here.
And maybe Mr. Beattie can follow up with me at some point in the near future, but I guess I'm curious about the size and scope of your organization, YIPA. What are the administrative costs, and are we doing other youth intervention, either through corrections or through public safety? Are there other youth intervention dollars that are being spent outside of YIPA? I'd be interested to understand, you know, who's delivering it, who's delivering the services the cheapest. If this is the way to do youth intervention, let's figure out how much we're going to spend on youth intervention and do it through YIPA. But if corrections or somebody else is doing it more efficiently, I want to understand that.
Maybe Mr. Krager, you can help us with this to try to ensure that we're not duplicating services in the state.
Yeah, just one quick thing. YIPA does not administer this. I just need to make sure that you understand that the Department of Public Safety administers these dollars. We just represent these organizations. The funding doesn't come through us. It goes through the Department of Corrections and goes direct, or the Department of Public Safety and goes directly to these programs. This is the association that brings these folks together. It provides training and technical assistance.
Of course, clarification.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'd just be curious then, Mr. Beattie, how big is your organization, and how is your organization, YIPA, funded?
YIPA is funded through grants, dues from the membership, foundations, McKnight Foundation, Bush Foundation, Otto Bremer Foundation. And we get 1% of the youth intervention funding to provide training and technical assistance to the grantees. But we also have, I mean, I can get into all sorts of, we have a very small budget, it's about $350,000, we have four staff. So I'd be glad to talk to you about
Chair, Mr. Beattie, I hope you will follow up with me.
We'll get that. Thank you, Mr. Beattie. Thank you for your testimony. We'll have you back when your bill comes up. With crime victims organizations, please come up now. Again, we're running short of time, and we have mentoring children of incarcerated parents yet, too. So if you could keep your remarks brief, please, and I think we get sort of what we're trying to get is what results are we getting for the expenditures of state dollars. I don't know who wants to go first here.
I will.
Please introduce yourself for the record and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chris Coles. I'm the director of Bijou Wabasaw Sexual Assault Services, and I've been in that position for the last 6 years. We serve Bijou and Wabasaw counties, obviously, which is about 1,300 square miles. We were established in 1991 by volunteers and became a standalone organization in 1996. We provide both direct services and outreach and education to our communities. In 2008, fiscal year 2008, we served 86 victims and provided 520 direct services. An example of how that works, we received a crisis line phone call from the hospital. A woman had come into the hospital having been sexually assaulted by her husband. Our advocate went and joined her for the examination, proceeded to follow with her to the law enforcement interview as well, then worked with the law enforcement officer to find her a safe place to stay for the evening because the women's shelter was full. The following day, we followed up with her, helped her receive a restraining order against her husband, a safe escort to her house. She was a diabetic, so she was able to get her medication so that she was able to maintain her health while she waited to be able to return home and get her belongings, and then she chose to move to another safer location. During the time that she was staying in the hotel, we assisted in covering the hotel costs. We also assisted in providing her with food and transportation for different errands that she needed to run. Regarding outreach and education, we educated 50 professionals last year, 619 students, and numerous community members. An example of that is that the prior year in a classroom, we had spoken about various needs of victims, victim rights, what sorts of things happen for victims, what their choices are. And we received a crisis phone call again from another hospital. A teenage woman had shown up there, a victim of sexual assault. She was a student in that classroom and had saved the business card, and so was specifically requesting an advocate based on the information that she had received about what an advocate does. So now on to the budget. Our agency budget for direct services and outreach and education is about $120,000. We have two staff for the two counties, and our Office of Justice Program funding is about $86,000 of that budget, and that includes the 4% increase, which we received, which, by the way, was our first increase in the last 10 years. And then that 4% increase amounts to about $4,000 for us. Our $4,000 we use to help retain our volunteer base. Our volunteer base is essential to us with a two-county, two-person program. Our volunteers provide about the equivalent of three full-time employees. So if you consider a base salary plus some basic insurance, you're looking at almost $105,000, which is nearly double our budget. The work that our volunteers do includes a lot of travel, obviously, to the victims. It also includes providing victims with basic meals and supplies if they need them at the time, emergency sorts of things. These are all things that we obviously want to be able to compensate our volunteers for because they are working very hard for us. They're giving us over 1,000 hours a year as individuals, and we certainly don't want them paying out of pocket. With increases in gas prices and with the economic downturn, they can't afford to be giving more than they already are to us. So, in short, the $4,000 increase helped us make sure that our volunteer program is viable and remains viable. It's one of the most vital parts of our agency's service delivery. We couldn't do our jobs without them. And during economic decline in transportation costs, it was essential for us. So thank you for the opportunity to address you today, and I'm willing to answer any questions you may have about my program.
Thank you for your testimony. Is it Coles?
It's Coles with your
file.
K-V-O-L-S.
Spelled differently.
No really.
Thank you for your testimony. Who's next? Carol or Ms. Arthur?
I am next. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carol Arthur. I'm the Executive Director of the Domestic Abuse Project in Minneapolis. Founded in 1979, DAP provides a combination of domestic violence therapy counseling for men who are abusive, women and children who are victims of domestic violence, and abusive adolescent boys. We also provide crisis intervention advocacy services similar to what you've heard described to victims of domestic violence, following up on domestic assault police arrest and gun on arrival reports in Minneapolis. I'm here today to share with you how important the state funding has been for our program and for other crime victim programs in the area of domestic violence and battered women's programs. DAP receives $176,174 from the Office of Justice Program. $42,740 of that is for our abused children's program, and $133,434 is for advocacy services for victims of domestic violence. This amount is a 5% increase over funding that we received in fiscal year 2007, so the last biennium. We got a slight increase, and we're especially appreciative of that. We, again, have received no increase in support for our advocacy services from the state since 2000, and in fact, in 2004, we had a 1% reduction in support from the state. Since 2005, we have had a 20% increase in the number of clients we've served at our agency. Last year, we saw 4,257 men, women, and children at DAP. The 5% increase allowed our program to respond to this increase in need. It also allowed us in this past year to respond to the cuts to courts in Hennepin County. Due to state cuts to the courts, we lost two court clerks of four in our county who helped victims of domestic violence complete orders for protection. Community-based advocates have responded to that loss in court personnel by receiving referrals from the courts to write those orders for protection. After the court cuts, an average of 20 women a week were turned away from the county office on the first day they came to apply for the order. They were told to come back the next day for the next day. This increase also allowed us to maintain a diverse advocacy staff who speak Spanish, Somali, Oromo, and Swahili to communicate with and reach out to those victims isolated from services by language, culture, and even lack of knowledge about knowing there are services available to them. It also allowed us to maintain our outreach office at Little Earth of United Tribes Housing in Minneapolis. Additionally, the $176,174 grant from the state is leveraged against our $1.5 million budget with funding from the City of Minneapolis, Hennepin County, Greater Twin Cities United Way Foundation and corporate grant support, as well as individual contributions. Of these funding sources, the state is roughly 12% of our budget. We also believe that we save our city, our county, and our state money. For every arrest we can prevent, we save at least $3,000. For every emergency room admission averted, we save $739. For every domestic homicide we can prevent, it is conservatively estimated at $20,000. Those surviving members of families will tell you it's priceless. Finally, I want to share with you the quality outcomes we have been able to achieve. Based on OJP's independent survey results compiled by the Wilder Research Project, DAP program participants reported 100% that the services they received were helpful, provided new information about how to keep themselves and their children safe, and provided the services they needed and wanted. In our abused children's program, 91% of the children could identify where to go for help and how to call the police or another helper person. 82% of the children could identify that the abuse was not their fault, and they could verbalize and deal with the feelings they had related to seeing the abuse or experiencing the abuse themselves. DAP is only one of the crime victim programs funded by OJP to provide services to victims of domestic violence. Since 2000, crime victim grants and battered women's shelter per diem has been reduced by 32.6%. The increase last biennium was the first since 2000. We are grateful for this increase, and we ask that the House hold the line on safety for battered women and their children. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Arthur. Ms. Sun, do you have any? We only have a couple minutes left, if we.
Ms. Chair and members of the committee, I'm just here to be a resource if there are questions. The general crime victim representative was unable to be here because of the weather.
I see. Okay. Any questions? We will have you back again, but we appreciate, I think that all the testimony from all of these groups demonstrates the, in my view, the importance of state investment in crime prevention and intervention and what we save in the long run in terms of money as well as human cost. So I really appreciate your testimony, unless you have a closing remark.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for coming on a cold day. Then we'll have the last presentation, the Mentoring Children of Incarcerated Parents.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Phil Griffin. Linda Sandvig and I represent Big Brothers and Big Sisters of the Greater Twin Cities Area of Lobbyists. We thank you for the opportunity to be here with you today to discuss Mentoring of Children of Prisoners Grant. This program began as a federal grant, and we brought this to the Minnesota Legislature because of the overwhelming need and demand for these services. At this point, I'd like to let our witnesses speak for themselves about the program, but before I do that, I'd like to make five very brief points. First, I'd like to thank the chairman and the committee for this bill. The chairman was the chief author last session, and the foresight that he had, and your foresight in bringing the needs for preventing increased costs in the criminal justice system, we think are admirable. We're well aware of the budget constraints that face the state of Minnesota, and we want to point out to the committee that we have used these funds to leverage private funds to support this program. While there is a need for more than 20 times the number of children that we're currently serving, the request this year is limited to just ongoing funding of the program as it exists. The chair was correct last session when he pointed out to the committee that the need to invest in programs to break the cycle of incarceration are one of the needs that we have rather than simply funding continued incarceration. Mr. Chairman, with those brief comments, let me introduce our witnesses, and we know that you're under a very tight time constraint. We have with us today Darlene Bell at my far left, your right, who is the staff person for community outreach and volunteer recruitment, but we brought her today because of her role as a mentor of children in this program. And she has a mentee who was with us in the Senate committee last week. She could not be with us because she's in school this morning, and we didn't want to pull her out, but we may do that when we have the bill in front of us. I also have with us Anne Marie Shotwell, who is the match support coordinator for this program, and she is to my right, your left, Indiana Nuremberg, Vice President of Research and Education and Special Projects. And Darlene, I think I'm going to turn to you and Mr. Chairman. If there are other questions at the end, I'd be happy to try and answer them.
Thank you. Ms. Bell, welcome to the committee.
Good morning. I'm a big sister.
Can you, just for the record, could you introduce yourself? Thanks.
I'm sorry. I'm Darlene Bell, and I am the manager for community outreach and volunteer recruitment for Big Brothers Big Sisters.
Thank you.
And I'm also a big sister. I'm a big sister to a little sister in the MCOP program, and me and my little have been matched now for a little over a year. My experience as a big has been life-changing for both me, myself, my little sister, and my little sister's family as a whole. The program not only serves my little sister, but it does impact the entire family. My little sister's family has faced some severe hardships in 2008. Just to name a few, they've been homeless twice. They have just now been evicted once again. And our program, just the services that our program provides, aren't just for the little sister, but it's for the entire program. The entire family. My little, now her grades have increased significantly. She's also not talking about running away anymore. She was involved in drugs, and she's only 13 years old. So just to know that somebody's there to stand in the gap for her has made a huge difference. For Christmas 2008, I asked my little, what would you like for Christmas for you and your family? And her reply was groceries. And that is literally what we stood in the gap and did. We purchased food and a couple educational games for the family, but food, which you would never even think from a mentoring program. So this program has helped immensely in this child's life. And I've been a big now. She's my third little that I've had. So it's made a huge difference in the life of this child and in this family.
Thank you for your testimony. Yeah. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Deanna Nurnberg, and I'm the Vice President of Evaluation for Big Brothers Big Sisters. We appreciate the chance to talk with you briefly this morning about the program. We began to serve children with state support in the 2006-2007 year, and since that time, we have helped to create approximately 350 new mentoring relationships and to serve 550 children overall, including continuing mentoring relationships that last more than a year. Within the packets I provided, there is a four-page report that includes some of the detailed outcomes of the children in the program. So I won't highlight all of them, but I will give you a brief overview. Each year we gather information from all of the children that we serve related to their status in 21 key asset areas, in the areas of confidence, and capacity for caring to see if they've improved or maintained or reduced their assets in those areas. And we're pleased to share that we're finding that the children in the Mentoring Children of Prisoners program are following pretty closely to their other peers throughout DBS's program, which is not something that we would expect. The children in this program face far, far more barriers than the children in our regular program, and we really expected to see that they were not doing as well. But with the caring and dedicated volunteers, they are managing to build and improve their capacities. For instance, 91% of the littles in our MCOP program have maintained or improved their academic performance. Nearly 93% have maintained or improved their classroom participation. 96.7% have maintained or improved their avoidance of substance abuse. And 90% have maintained or improved their avoidance of delinquency. I'd like to share this program serves the greater Twin Cities, but we also partner with Big Brothers Big Sisters of Southern Minnesota to serve Southern Minnesota. And together we serve an area with far more eligible children and families than we can possibly serve in any given year with available funding and volunteer mentors. Further, we partner with the Council on Crime and Justice, Search Institute, and several other local agencies. We're part of the Transition Coalition, for instance, to ensure that we are making parents aware of our program. We are providing resources to the families that we serve as well as our mentors so that they can address the barriers that the children face. The children who are served through our Mentoring Children Prisoners program have access to all of Big Brothers Big Sisters programs, including our Education and Enrichment program, which started 2 years ago, which is designed to help the youth that we serve who are predominantly low-income. 85% of the children who are in the Mentoring Children of Prisoners program are low-income, to plan for and pursue post-secondary education. And we have two littles who are now of an age that we're helping them to seek funding for college. We now have 52 children who've received financial aid and our assistance to attend college, and we expect the number to continue to grow. And so all of our programs are available to littles, and Anne-Marie will talk briefly about some of the special services we do under this project that provide additional resources to these children. In addition, we have provided a summary of our budget, including how we have used the state funding and resources to support four primary areas through this program. On community relations and partnerships, including providing services in southern Minnesota and additional services through the Council on Crime and Justice. We undertake mentor and youth recruitment. For instance, Darlene does recruiting in the prison. She just met with the Department of Corrections about expanding our outreach into several new prisons, but she does go, for instance, to the Shakopee facility, and she's attended resource fairs and met with staff to make parents aware of the program in case they want to refer their children to us. In addition, we do extensive mentor recruitment. Along with most mentoring programs, mentors are our limiting factor in how many children we can serve. And so we do extensive research to find individuals who are caring and willing to give of themselves to help us out. We provide ongoing MAP support and case management to ensure child safety, child development, and positive asset acquisition. And then we provide special mentor training and also special family training to families involved in this program. Overall, we anticipate we will serve approximately 475 to 500 youth through the Mentoring Children of Prisoners program this year. At our average mentoring, it costs the agency approximately $1,400 per child per served per year. So the total cost for this program is in excess of $665,000. We have been able to leverage with the state support $150,000 over 3 years from a federal grant, and we supplement it with private funds raised from a number of resources.
What is the overall budget for Big Brothers Big Sisters?
It was $1.2 million this year. So the state funding represents 7% of our total budget, and the MCOP program represents nearly 13%.
Thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chair, my name is Anne-Marie Shotwell. I'm the MASH Support Mentoring Children of Prisoners Coordinator for Big Brothers Big Sisters of the Greater Twin Cities. I want to thank you guys first for letting us come speak today, and I'm just going to take a couple minutes to tell you a little bit more about what our program has done specifically. To ensure that our staff at Big Brothers Big Sisters is educated in the needs of children and prisoners, we have brought in Ann Adelis Estrin from the Family Corrections Network to conduct an intense 2-day staff training. allowing us to better understand these children's special needs and in turn be able to better support the matches by providing appropriate support and activities to help these children build assets and avoid delinquency. The families in our program need our services now more than ever. With the tough economic times we're all facing, our families are really feeling the brunt of it. Homelessness and hunger are just two of the serious issues that our volunteers are facing when they get together with their littles. This year, as Darlene mentioned, we were able to help her family with some Christmas presents, and as she mentioned, we were given a grocery list, and all they wanted was really to be able to have dinner on Christmas. Our volunteers have really become advocates for us, utilizing us and allowing us to collaborate with other community agencies that can help them. This has really provided a secondary safety net to ensure that our most vulnerable youth are not falling through the gap, as these families' needs are much more acute than what we find in our other programs. Some of the activities that we provide the matches in this program with are activities that help them step outside their comfort zone and explore something new, like rock climbing or dance classes. We also provide community service activities to remind them that everyone has something to give back. Activities such as Feed My Starving Children, making blankets for the crisis nursery, collecting canned goods, or cleaning up their neighborhood park. With this program, we're working to do more than create a lasting friendship. We're breaking the cycle. We're laying the groundwork for many of these children to be the first one in their family to graduate high school, the first one in their family to go to college, and for some of them, the first one to not go to prison. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions of any of the presenters? Attorney Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's not so much for the presenters, although thank you very much for your testimony, but I just was thinking maybe as we go through these and as we look at the various things that we fund in the public safety area, maybe I had the wrong question about federal funding. Maybe it's really how much private funding is leveraged by each of these programs and how much particular foundations. And I just wonder whether there's a way for us to kind of gather that information as we go along so that as we make choices, we'll know if we're losing other private match dollars or how much each program would be leveraging from outside of the state funding. Is there a way to do that?
Mr. Carver, can we do that? I think that's an excellent point.
Yeah. I think, Mr. Chair, Representative, I think we could if we started asking the program and just getting that information from the program.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Liebling, Ms. Zimmer did provide you with our experience on that, and we'll be happy to put that in writing for the committee and let you know.
And maybe if any of the presenters from the other organizations are here, they're gone now. We should get that information. I think that would be very helpful. Any other questions? Thank you all for your testimony. We'll have you back and talk over your budget and your request in greater detail. Thank you, members. If you have ideas, obviously we went through this very quickly, but if you have ideas that for our hearings before and after the governor's budget comes out, please bring them to Ms. McMahon. It's not that I don't know her name. It's not Ms. Lacombe anymore, but it's Ms. McMahon, so if you were thinking I was being disrespectful to the committee administrator, I was not. Meeting adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.